Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. For the next 45 minutes or so, I'll be bringing you up to speed on recent developments in the area of public safety labor relations. Got a lot to cover here. I know I'm not going to get through it all. I've got six cases from around the country on various issues, a major case from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court on the firefighters' presumption, got a Garrity case, got a Weingart. We got lots of things to talk about. But before I dive into that, I do want to thank everybody who participated in our survey that we did on podcasts. I'll tell you the results, which are slightly overwhelming, which are that you would prefer to see not one but two different podcasts over the course of each month, so roughly every other week or bi-monthly. The sentiment seems to be that what we could do would be to do two shorter form podcasts, maybe a half hour each time, or 45 minutes, and cover more material over the course of the month. We're going to mull that over internally at LRAS, figure out what we're going to do, and I'll announce it probably in next month's podcast. I'll tell you, we're very much leaning towards going the twice a month system. It'll be interesting. Secondly, we've upped our game in the podcasting department. The revenues have been flowing in. Actually, they haven't. We don't take any money for the podcast. But we've decided to buy an entirely new set of recording equipment. So as I am recording this, I'm feeling very much like a DJ in an oldies station right now with one of those boom mics with a foam protector on it. And we've got equalizers and more wires than we know what to do with. Mark Fuller, our LRIS technical wizard, understands all this. I don't really pretend to understand. Well, I pretend to understand it, but I don't really understand it. Hopefully, this will give us a more consistent sound quality, particularly when we get into the interviews that we do from time to time. And I know we're overdue on those interviews. I do want to get to some. I've got several people in mind that I'd like to talk to. Last thing, the survey went over so well. We got a lot of responses. We want to do a survey on our seminars. And you can go to our website, LRIS.com, and answer these survey questions. I'll tell you what we're thinking about here. For many years, we did six national seminars at various places around the country. We'd hold them on the East Coast and the West Coast. Typically, we would hold two of them, maybe three of them in Las Vegas, and then the rest of them we would put in other places. We've been to Chicago and New York and Miami and Orlando and Dallas and San Diego and San Francisco. We've been all over the place with our seminars. As time went by, we couldn't help but notice that the highest amount of attendance was always in Las Vegas. No matter what the topic was, no matter what the time of year was, we would get more people coming to our seminars in Las Vegas than anywhere else. And that created a pressure for us because we want more people at the seminars. It's what keeps LRIS going. That created a pressure for us to move our seminars to Las Vegas. I was kind of the last holdout in the LRIS on that issue because I really do think there's a value, a public value, to having these seminars all over the place. But then we had a back-to-back seminar. It was on internal affairs. It was a police seminar. Back-to-back seminars. One was in Orlando, Florida, at a perfect time of year in the fall in Orlando. And the other was in Las Vegas the following year. Same seminar, same agenda, same speakers. More Florida attendees went to Las Vegas than went to Orlando. And that made me just kind of shrug my shoulders and say, okay, I give up. This is where everybody wants to go. I know some people don't like to go to Las Vegas, and but still, that is, you know, the people have spoken, vox populi. Well, we're not giving up on the notion. of having seminars in other places around the country. We're looking at, for our agenda in 2020, our seminar agenda, we're looking at going back to 6 seminars and having at least one of them somewhere to the east of the Rocky Mountains. We're looking at cities like Chicago, Boston, San Antonio, New Orleans, Fort Lauderdale, or Miami, maybe even Nashville, Tennessee. But what we'd like you to do is go to our website and call up the survey and tell us not where you would like to go, but where you would go if we put a seminar there. Do you think we would do better with respect to attendance by having a seminar in, for example, Fort Lauderdale, as opposed to having it in Las Vegas? We really do care what you think on this issue, so any time you can spend with that survey, just take a couple minutes to fill out. Be most appreciative. Now, on to the cases.
Hey, everyone. This is LRIS Seminar Coordinator Claire Cowan. I'd like to add an incentive for completing that seminar survey. We'll be picking one respondent at random to win a $25 Amazon gift card. It's not a $1 billion Powerball drawing, but your chances of winning are a lot better. There will be a link on this month's podcast posting, and I'll put one on the LRIS.com homepage. And now, back to Will.
The first case I want to talk about comes to us from the Federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the federal court of appeals that covers the western states. The Ninth Circuit isn't always known for the brevity of its opinions, but it issued a pretty succinct, I think very well done opinion on the basic question of when do chiefs get due process? When do fire chiefs or police chiefs or assistant sheriffs, when are they entitled to due process before they are terminated? So let me set the stage a little bit for you from the legal standpoint, and then we'll dive into the facts of this particular case. Due process rights really come in two flavors, depending upon whether the employee has a property right to the job. If a property right to the job exists, and just placeholder there, I'll come back and talk about how you get a property right to the job. If a property right exists, then the employee is entitled to at least a pre-disciplinary or pre-termination hearing. These hearings are, in most places in the country, called Loudermill hearings, after the name of a Supreme Court decision that described them. In California, you folks down there call them Skelly hearings. Same concept. The whole notion is that the employee should have some opportunity, pre-discipline, to get notice of the charges against them, to prepare for whatever the hearing might be, and the chance to make a presentation to the disciplinary decision maker or a delegee of the decision maker who does have the authority to make effective recommendations as to why the proposed disciplinary sanction should be changed. That's procedural due process under the Loudermill case, the ability for the employee to state their side of the case, offer mitigating circumstances, challenge the employer's tentative decision. Now, how do employees get property rights to the job? They get them if there are some sort of disciplinary standards in place that remove them from the status of being at-will employees. The default relationship in employment is that all of us are at-will employees. That can be changed if the employer has agreed to give us some sort of job protections. And for most public safety employees, they have those job protections. They may be through a collective bargaining agreement or memorandum of understanding that requires the employer to show just cause for discipline. That's a modification of the at-will status of the employee. It may be through a civil service system or a police board or fire board that applies some version of a just cause standard. Anything that modifies the at-will status of the employee in such a way that the employer has to have a reason to take disciplinary action against the employee, that's likely to create a property right to the job. Now, employees who don't have property rights to the job can still have another form of due process right. These are called liberty rights. I don't think I've ever talked about these on the podcast because they just don't come up all that often. The Supreme Court long ago held that public employees have the right to follow, the phrasing of the court was, their chosen trade and profession. And that if an employer makes public statements about the reasons for the employee's termination that are false, the employer has impacted the liberty right for that employee to go get another job somewhere. And the employer must then provide the employee with a name-clearing hearing in which the employee can attempt to correct whatever the record is. So liberty rights, not nearly as detailed and as rigorous as property rights in terms of the due process that they demand, but they still demand something, and they demand this name-clearing hearing. All right, now let's turn to the case that the Ninth Circuit used as a vehicle to describe all of this. And this is a case involving Spokane, Washington Police Chief Frank Straub. Now, Straub had a 3-year tenure as police chief in the Spokane Police Department. I think pretty much everybody would say it was a rocky tenure. And that tenure culminated in 2015 when the leaders of the supervisory police union, supervisory unions have collective bargaining rights in Washington. The leaders of the supervisory unions met with the mayor of Spokane and advised him that they wouldn't, and I'm going to quote now, tolerate any further unprofessional behavior by Straub. The union sent a memo to the mayor, and what the memo said, and I'm going to read you a couple of sentences from it. You'll get the flavor. Members of this association reported several specific examples of unprofessional and even hostile behavior directed towards themselves or other members by Chief Straub. It often included profanity, personal degradation, or other behavior not becoming the office of the Spokane Police Chief. His behavior has created a workplace environment inconsistent with collaboration and contrary to effective leadership. Well, the mayor stews on that a little bit, and he asks for and receives Straub's resignation. Straub then sues, and he says, "The termination violated my due process rights." That's the issue that goes up to the Ninth Circuit. Did Straub have any due process rights? Well, the court very quickly disposes of the question of whether he had a property right to the job. In other words, did the city have to give him a Loudermill hearing? And the court says no. He's an at-will employee. There's nothing that modifies his status as an at-will employee. Therefore, no property right to the job. What could he have had that might have given him a property right? He could have had a contract with the city. There are many chiefs who do have contracts that call for just cause or some variation of it. Could have had that, but he didn't. So no property right to the job. Next question for the court. Does he have a liberty right to the job? Court answers that easily as well. Yeah, he does. He's a public employee. It doesn't matter whether he has a property right. He still has this liberty right to a name-clearing hearing. And then the guts of the court's opinion deals with when does he get this hearing, this name-clearing hearing. Does he get it, as Straub wanted it, before his termination, or does he get it afterwards? And the court says afterwards, which is what happened in Straub's case. The court acknowledges Straub had an interest in a hearing prior to the loss of his job and the press release, of course, that was attendant to the loss of his job. However, the court said, the city had its own interest in removing the head of its police department, a high-profile position, and a strong interest in, and I'm quoting, quickly executing that decision and communicating its rationale to the public. Indeed, says the court, if due process required a pre-deprivation hearing in such circumstances, public employers would have an incentive to terminate at-will employees without public explanation. Now, think about that for a moment. These liberty right cases, think of them as sort of the equivalent of constitutional defamation. So the employer's making a statement about the employee that is false. And the name-clearing hearing is this opportunity to correct the false nature of those statements. What the Ninth Circuit is saying here is look, if you require these name-clearing hearings pre-termination, which is what Straub wants, employers simply aren't going to say anything at all. They're just simply going to look at somebody like Straub and say, you're fired, period, end of issue. And since there's no public statement that would be false, there would be no need for the name clearing or liberty hearing. And the court is saying here, we want there to be these sorts of hearings. They're going to have to happen after the fact, but we want them to occur. By the way, this is one of the few times the Ninth Circuit has ever addressed these name-clearing hearings. They've been addressed a lot in various places around the country, probably disproportionately so in the southeastern part of the country, where it's not just chiefs who don't have property rights to the job, but in many places it's right down to rank-and-file firefighters and police officers who don't have property rights to the job. That's where you see a lot of these name-clearing hearing cases. And what the Ninth Circuit articulates here, which is that the name-clearing hearing follows termination, that is the majority rule, the overwhelming majority rule in the country. The Ninth Circuit's not blazing a new trail here on this issue. Now let's move over to Pennsylvania and that major cancer presumption case. Pennsylvania, like many states in the country, most states in the country, has for workers' compensation purposes a presumption that certain types of illnesses are caused by the job. These presumptions, sometimes they're called heart-lung presumptions, even though they're much broader than that. They apply many times to conditions that have nothing to do with the heart or the lung, like cancer. Some of them actually apply to various infectious diseases like hepatitis. So these sorts of statutes, the way they work is they say, look, if the whoever it is who's covered by this presumption, most of them, in fact, all of them that I know of cover firefighters. Many of them also cover law enforcement officers. So if you have someone who has this condition, the presumption is it's caused by the job. It's called a rebuttable presumption because then the employer can bring in evidence that challenges whether or not the cancer was caused by the job and can effectively rebut the presumption. So in these states, simply that a firefighter or a law enforcement officer has, for example here, cancer, doesn't mean they're automatically covered by workers' compensation. The presumption can be rebutted, and the employer can avoid liability for the workers' compensation injury. What the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has to decide in this case is what's exactly is the burden of proof in these cases? What is it that the, in this case, this is a firefighter case, what is it that the firefighter has to show? What types of evidence will satisfy that burden of proof? And then what's the quality of evidence that the employer has to bring in order to rebut the presumption? And those sound like kind of arcane questions, but they really matter, and they matter in terms of how many firefighters and anybody else covered by the statute are going to receive workers' compensation benefits. And also, I just really like kind of the intellectual part of these cases as to the analysis of the burden of proof and that sort of thing. So I think it matters from the standpoint of just reading the law. So what's this case all about? This is about a Philadelphia firefighter, a guy named Scott Sladek. Before he became a firefighter, Sladek took a health examination, pre-employment, and that established that he had not been treated for cancer in the past and that he was presently cancer-free. Sladek has a pretty good career with the department. He gets a number of promotions, and eventually he becomes a battalion chief in November of 2007. That same year, he's diagnosed with malignant melanoma, and he underwent a surgical procedure to remove the cancerous lesion from the back of his thigh. And that all happened throughout the course of 2007. He files a workers' compensation claim that finally makes it to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court 11 years later in 2018. Sladek's claim says, look, I've got a melanoma. It resulted from a direct exposure to group 1 carcinogens, and the Pennsylvania statute is triggered by the presumptive causation statute, is triggered by exposure to group 1 carcinogens. So I've been exposed to these, and my workers' compensation claim should be approved. The city says, no, we're denying the claim. We don't think there's any evidence that your particular cancer, here's firefighter or battalion chief Sladek, we don't think that your particular cancer was caused by the job. So the court, when it takes a look at this, has to answer 3 basic questions. And the first is, does a firefighter have to prove that his or her cancer was caused by a specific group 1 carcinogen in order to get the benefits of this presumptive causation statute? Does a firefighter have to prove the link between whatever the carcinogen might be and this particular cancer that the firefighter has? And the court answers the question, no, the firefighter doesn't have to prove it. Instead, all the firefighter has to prove is that it is possible that the carcinogen in question caused the type of cancer that the firefighter has. The presumptive causation statute doesn't require the firefighter to prove that this particular carcinogen actually caused the firefighter's cancer. Why? And here's a quote from the court on this. The statute embodies a legislative acknowledgement that firefighting is a dangerous occupation that routinely exposes firefighters to group 1 carcinogens that are known to cause various types of cancer. The burden imposed on the firefighters, burden of proof, is not a heavy burden. Okay, so that's question number 1. Does the firefighter have to show that his or her cancer was caused by a particular carcinogen? We know the answer then is no. So what is it that the firefighter actually has to prove? That's question 2. And the question is, the way the court puts it, is can general epidemiological evidence establish this general causation? The general causation being that it's possible that the carcinogen in question caused the type of cancer that the firefighter has. Can epidemiological evidence meet that burden of proof of general causation so as to bring the firefighter within the scope of the presumptive causation statute? And the court says epidemiological evidence is enough. Epidemiological evidence would be evidence along the lines of the frequency of certain types of cancers in firefighting and the relationship between that and the frequency of exposure to certain types of group 1 carcinogens. That would be the sort of epidemiological evidence you'd be looking at. So why is the court saying that epidemiological evidence is good enough? The court, here's another couple lines from the court's opinion. The court says I knew I was going to mispronounce this. This word always is daunting for me. Epidemiology deals with the identification of potentially causative associations in various populations between possible causative agents and the resulting incidence of particular diseases, and seeks to generalize those results. Given its focus on identifying causal relationships and the resulting incidence of disease, drumroll, here comes the conclusion, epidemiology's focus on statistical analysis may be uniquely suited to illuminate whether there's a general causal relationship between the types of cancers and group 1 carcinogens. So in other words, firefighter can come in and get within the scope of the presumptive causation statute simply with a statistical case, one that shows the rate of incidence of cancer. Now, for the third question that the court deals with, if epidemiological evidence is good enough to meet the firefighter's burden of proof, is it good enough to allow the employer to use it to rebut evidence that the firefighter's cancer was caused by the job? And this is a little bit more of a subtle question, because this is using evidence that normally you would think would establish a link. I mean, in order to get to this stage in the analysis under a rebuttable presumption case, the firefighter already has to have shown the statistical link. And the question here is, can the employer use that same sort of evidence, a lack of a statistical link, in order to escape the coverage of the presumptive causation statute? And the court says no. The court says the evidence that an employer has to come up with to rebut the presumption must show that the firefighter's cancer, whoever the claimant is here, was not caused by the occupation of firefighting. The court's opinion turns on a particular phrase in the statute, and it is the phrase, the firefighter's cancer. And the court said that means that the employer has to show that not only was there some other specific causative agent for the firefighter's cancer, something else, maybe smoking, whatever it might be, and it also has to show that exposure to that causative agent, what actually caused the firefighter's cancer, didn't occur as a result of employment as a firefighter. In other words, says the court, the statute requires the employer to produce a medical opinion regarding the specific non-firefighting related cause of the claimant's cancer. Now, you may be listening to this and think, wow, that seems odd that the firefighter can use this generalized statistical epidemiological evidence, but the employer can't use it to rebut the presumption. But when you think about the purpose of these laws, it's not actually such an odd result. The purpose behind these laws is we just simply don't know enough yet about what all the causative agents of cancer are. I mean, goodness knows, we're still debating the effect of genetics on cancer, not to mention any of a number of different environmental and lifestyle exposures that may have an impact on cancer. The statutes say, one thing we do know is that we put certain types of public safety employees, we put them into a position of harm by requiring that they, as a condition of their job, expose themselves to what we know to be disease-causing agents. In that circumstance, we think it's right that the employer, all of us, government, bear the cost of the occasional claim that maybe shouldn't have been granted, rather than individual firefighters and other public safety employees losing more than the occasional claim that should have been granted. Now, this is not a case that was a slam dunk for the court. This is one where when you're tallying up the votes on this, the seven-member Pennsylvania Supreme Court, you actually need a kind of a chalkboard to keep track of them. The court's seven justices actually split in several different directions on all three of these questions, and there's a mass of concurring and dissenting opinions. You can pretty much anticipate that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court will revisit this issue if and when the composition of the court changes from a political standpoint, may have a different point of view from the court. But for now, this is certainly the law in Pennsylvania. And this is one of these areas, presumptive causation, because the issue gets litigated so much in Pennsylvania as opposed to other states, where as Pennsylvania goes, you might be making a pretty good bet that if you've got a presumptive causation statute in your state, the courts in your state will go the same direction. Next up, a pretty interesting Weingarten case that comes to us from Illinois, from the Illinois, actually it's the Educational Labor Relations Board. And in spite of that name, this is actually a public safety case. This involves a police officer. Let me give you the facts of the case, and then I do want to set up, though, for you that what this decision is going to analyze is what are the employer's options when, if at the start of an interview, the employee says, I want my union rep. If the employee asserts his or her Weingarten rights. What are the choices that the employer has? That's where we're going to get. Okay, now into the facts. And trust me on this one, I am not making up these facts, although you're going to accuse me of that probably. So this is a case that involves a police officer. Her name is Lori Hermesdorf, who works for the Elgin Community College. This is why this ends up before the Illinois Educational Labor Relations Board. Hermesdorf is a member of a bargaining unit represented by what's known as the Metropolitan Alliance of Police. I'll just simply call them MAP for purposes of this podcast. Hermesdorf is the subject of a complaint that's filed by a citizen alleging that she blocked him, pushed him back, and stopped him from entering, get ready, the men's restroom. The citizen complained about the display of what he thought were poor communication skills and bad treatment by Hermesdorf, and the citizen claimed that as a result, he was unable to sleep, very stressed out, and that he felt denigrated. I told you, you thought I was going to be making this stuff up. So what does the department do when it gets this complaint? Before it interviews Hermesdorf about the incident, both the college's president and the police chief had already apologized to the citizen for, and I'm quoting, the unprofessional conduct and behavior exhibited by Hermesdorf. So before the investigation starts, they have determined that Hermesdorf is guilty. It kind of reminds you, do you remember the courtroom scene in Alice in Wonderland when, boy, I don't remember this as well as I should. I want to say it's the Queen utters the phrase, sentence first, trial later. It kind of reminds you of that a little bit. At any rate, the chief goes on to tell the citizen that Hermesdorf's actions didn't reflect the standards of conduct to which all of the college's police officers were held. And he promises that both he and a deputy chief would personally investigate the incident and follow up with the citizen regarding the matter. I'm pretty sure there's not enough going on in the chief's office in the Elgin Community College Police Department if the police chief and the deputy chief are going to personally investigate a complaint about an officer denying a citizen bathroom privileges. Well, the deputy chief summons Hermesdorf to an interview that is going to be conducted by the chief and deputy chief. Hermesdorf says, I want my MAP representative. I want my union representative. The chief denies the request, proceeds with the interview. Although Hermesdorf ends up not being disciplined as a result of this, MAP nonetheless files an unfair labor practice complaint against the college, saying that the denial of Hermesdorf's request for representation was a violation of the Weingarten Rule. I'm sure you all know this, but the Weingarten Rule stems from a 1975 case from the U.S. Supreme Court, where the court held that it's an unfair labor practice for an employer to deny an employee's request for union representation at an investigatory interview where the employee reasonably believes discipline could result from the interview. So this goes to the Educational Labor Relations Board, and the board says unfair labor practice. It starts by saying, did Hermesdorf have a reasonable belief that discipline could result from the interview? Sure, says the board. You have a citizen who filed a complaint after he told her that he was going to file a complaint. She gets summoned to a meeting with a deputy chief and a chief, and they're asking questions. Of course, it's reasonable for Hermesdorf to anticipate that discipline could occur. It doesn't matter that it didn't occur. What you're looking at in these Weingarten cases is kind of a point of sale assessment. At the moment that the questions are being asked, is it reasonable for the employee to believe that discipline could result from the questioning? And the board says, yes, it was. All right, so now let's get to kind of the heart of the matter. What is it the employer is supposed to do after Hermesdorf asserts her Weingarten rights? In this case, what the employer did was to go ahead and conduct the interview. Can't do it, says the board. The board says, look, and I'm going to quote a few sentences here. In the routine disciplinary situation, the employer may deny the request for representation, discontinue the interview, and proceed to obtain information from other sources. However, if the employee requests representation and the request is denied, the employer violates the law if it continues to conduct the interview. The employer, of course, is arguing that, look, Hermesdorf here waived her Weingarten rights by continuing to participate in the interview. And the board says, no, that's actually not the case. You know, in this sort of situation, you're looking across the table at the chief and a deputy chief, and they are asking you questions. Your job's to answer those questions. The violation of the law has already occurred. And if we're going to hold that there's some sort of waiver of Weingarten rights, it's going to have to happen earlier in the process before the questioning starts. And we're going to need that waiver to be, and I'm quoting, clear and unmistakable. By the way, what's the remedy when an employer violates the Weingarten rights of it's really the labor organization's Weingarten rights, kind of derivatively, it's the members. What's the remedy? There's really a couple of levels of remedy. First of all, if the employee is actually disciplined, the typical remedy is suppression, suppression of the employee's statements and the fruits of the statement. In addition to that, kind of the second tier of remedies, which would apply even in a case like this where the employee is not actually disciplined, is the employer is going to have to post notice that it committed an unfair labor practice. And by posting, I mean notifying all employees in the bargaining unit that its actions violated the right to representation. Those are the typical remedies you see in these cases. Next up, a New Jersey case. This is a Garrity case. And the question is whether or not a compelled statement made by an employee can be used to prosecute the employee for perjury or other crimes related to the dishonest nature of the employee's compelled statement. Okay, so let me set the stage a little bit with respect to Garrity, then we'll get into the facts of the case and we'll talk about how the court resolved the question. So Garrity, of course, a long time ago, Supreme Court decision. It's now over 50 years old. Isn't that incredible? Garrity holds that an employer, a public employer, even though it is the government, has the right to force employees to give statements related to the job, even if those statements are potentially incriminating of the employee's participation in a criminal offense. However, the ability for the government to force employees to make these statements, because it is the government, it's subject to the Fifth Amendment's privilege against compulsory self-incrimination, the ability to force employees to make those statements comes at a price. And the price is that neither the statements nor the fruits of the statements can be used to criminally prosecute the employee. Garrity's a rule of immunity. It gives the employer the right to force the employee to make statements and to take disciplinary action on the basis of the employee's statements, but it forbids the employer from using the statements in a subsequent criminal prosecution of the employee. So that's the basic Garrity rule that's at issue here. So now, what are the facts of this case? They're pretty simple. This involves a sheriff's officer with the Essex County Sheriff's Office in New Jersey. It's a fellow named Armando Noguera. On October 5th, there's an incident involving a fellow Essex County Sheriff's Officer, a fellow named John Warnock, and that results in criminal charges against Warnock. And those charges are that he restrained and threatened to sexually assault a woman. That all happens in 2012. Warnock's case, criminal case, goes to trial in 2014. Both the state and Warnock call Noguera as a witness, and a jury acquits Warnock of all charges against him. Sounds like we're all done. No, but we're not, are we? Because then a state grand jury indicts Noguera on charges of official misconduct, perjury, and false swearing. And to prove these charges, the state wants to introduce into evidence the statements that Noguera gave to investigators in the course of two internal investigations into the case against Warnock. They were compelled statements that Noguera gave. Noguera then files a motion to suppress the statements, citing Garrity, and a trial court agrees and suppresses the statements, and that goes up to the New Jersey Court of Appeals. And the New Jersey Court of Appeals says, that's not the way Garrity works in these kinds of cases. Garrity, says the court, forbids the use of the coerced statement to prove a prior criminal offense. Here, the coerced statement is in and of itself the criminal event. And there's nothing in Garrity that prohibits the use of a compelled statement to prove that the statement itself was given as either false swearing or as perjury. Quoting from the court's opinion here, the Fifth Amendment privilege is to be silent. It is not a privilege to commit crime. It has consistently been held that the Fifth Amendment privilege does not entitle a witness to commit perjury. The court concludes its opinion by talking about Noguera's obligation as a law enforcement officer to cooperate with the investigation into Warnock, that he had a duty to disclose to the investigators everything he knew of Warnock's interactions with the suspect. He had a duty to be candid and forthright and truthful. And the court says, if he, and I'm quoting, intentionally misrepresented his location to provide Warnock with a false alibi, that's what happened here, he must face the legal consequences of that decision. Garrity is not a license for law enforcement officers to commit future crimes. This isn't a terribly novel proposition. It comes up with some regularity. I'd say we see a case on this, every couple of years or so. And I think everybody just needs to remember, Garrity looks backwards. It looks at whether or not the statement is used to prove that a prior act occurred. That's the protection that Garrity gives. It does not, as this New Jersey court says, does not prevent prosecution based on the false nature of the statement itself. I want to wind up this podcast with a discussion of the latest firefighters rule case. If you've been listening to these podcasts for a while, you know that I just absolutely think the firefighters rule is bluntly stupid and has no place in our jurisprudence. What is the firefighters rule? It's the rule that firefighters and law enforcement officers can't bring lawsuits against those whose negligence injures them on the job. This is a rule that's been with us, first enunciated anywhere in this country in 1892 by the Illinois Supreme Court. So it's been with us, well over 100 years. I think of the firefighters rule as kind of like a cough that lingers long after your cold has gone away. It remains a feature of the law decades, scores of decades, after its theoretical underpinnings have long since been undermined. So where did we get this kind of odd rule that firefighters and law enforcement officers, alone among all employees, can't sue somebody whose negligence injures them on the job? Where did we get it from? Well, we got it, as I mentioned, from this Illinois Supreme Court decision in 1892, and this was a decision about something called premises liability, okay? What's premises liability? It's one of these rules that comes to us courtesy of old English jurisprudence and then gets modified when it's brought over to the New World. This thing's been around a long time. And what it describes is what obligation does a landowner or a land occupier, if it's somebody who's renting the property, what obligation do they have to someone who's injured on their property? And the whole notion behind premises liability is we answer that question by looking at the status of the person who comes onto the property. Are they, and I hate to get into using these words, but I got to, are they an invitee, a licensee, or a trespasser? Landowners owe the greatest obligations to invitees, virtually no obligations to trespassers, other than, refrain from like murdering them. Licensees were in the middle, but preciously close to trespassers. There wasn't really much of an obligation to licensees. And so the Illinois Supreme Court, way back in 1892, said firefighters, when they come onto someone's property to fight a fire, they are licensees, and the only duty that a landowner or occupant has is to refrain from the infliction of willful or intentional injury. Now, as we get into the 20th century, most courts around the country throw out the notions of premises liability. They found them really kind of uncomfortably rooted in these archaic principles of actually even pre-medieval British law. But the problem remained for the courts as they discarded these notions of premises liability, and that was they really kind of liked the result of the firefighters' rule. They really liked the notion that firefighters and then later law enforcement officers couldn't sue people for negligence when they were injured as part of their job. And so what happened, what you saw in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, was you saw courts shift the rationale behind the firefighter's rule. No longer was it this notion of premises liability as a firefighter, an invitee or a licensee or whatever. It instead shifted it to what you can think of as assumption of risk analysis. And the whole idea was that firefighters and law enforcement officers assume all risks of negligence when they perform their jobs on somebody else's property, and they do so by virtue of taking the jobs in the first place. Now, that's kind of where the majority of courts are with respect to the theoretical underpinnings of the firefighter's rule. There are still some that use some principles of premises liability. And there's another set of courts, California Supreme Court is the best example, where the court says that, look, the reason for the firefighter's rule is firefighters and law enforcement officers, they're well compensated by their pay and workers' compensation benefits. And so negligent landowners and occupants of the land should be excused from liability. See, you've got these different theories floating around. And there have been some states that have gotten rid of the firefighter's rule. In Oregon, for example, there's an Oregon Supreme Court decision. My case, I'm very proud to say, where the court said firefighter's rule makes no sense. We don't have an implied assumption of the risk in Oregon, so we're not going to have the firefighter's rule. Some other states have done that. Colorado did. Some states, New York is a good example, have passed statutes repealing the rule. But it is still the rule in the majority of states. And that's what Danville, Kentucky police officer Sharon Johnson just learned. Kentucky is a state that still follows the firefighter's rule. So what happens to Johnson? She's dispatched to a call about an individual who was intoxicated and stripping off his clothes and walking up the railroad tracks to the stockyards. Another officer's dispatched to the scene. A foot pursuit ensues, and Officer Johnson is injured in the foot pursuit. She falls down an embankment, injures her wrist and her eyes as a result of the fall. She sues the railroad company, Norfolk Southern, claiming that the embankment was a dangerous condition. And that's the case that ends up before the Kentucky Supreme Court. Should the firefighters' rule bar the lawsuit? The assumption is that the railroad is negligent. And the court says, we like the firefighter's rule. And I'm going to quote here. For reasons of public policy, our rule is that firemen, they're still using firemen, not firefighters, are required to assume the ordinary risks of employment, a dangerous occupation, to the extent necessary to serve the public purpose of fire control. And this provides the fireman's rule as a defense for those who are the owners and occupiers of the property. The purpose of the policy is to encourage owners and occupiers where they are faced with an emergency to call firefighters and police officers to respond. We don't want them deterred from calling firefighters and police officers by the possibility of potential liability. Hence, we have the firefighter's rule. Johnson's injury occurred while she was in the course of her job. She has no claim against Norfolk Southern, the railroad, even though it was negligent. Now, two points about this case that just really fry me. First of all, the court's rationale. Does anybody really think that an owner or occupier of land would not call a firefighter if there was a fire, or would not call a police officer if there was a crime being committed on their land because they were worried about potential liability if their negligence resulted in an injury to the firefighter or police officer? excuse me, but isn't that just like complete nonsense? That's not the way people behave. Second thing that gets me about this case is something the court doesn't analyze, but it's worth thinking about. Okay, so you've got someone who's negligent. Normally, in our system of jurisprudence, negligent people bear the consequences of their negligence. They're the ones who can be sued. They're the ones who have insurance, or even if they don't have to have insurance, they have to pay damages that is caused to somebody else by their failure to follow a reasonable standard of care. Why, in the context of firefighters and law enforcement officers, do we transfer the responsibility for that individual's negligence from the individual who is negligent to society as a whole? Why are we doing that? That doesn't really make much sense from a public policy standpoint. And the third thing I have to say about, and I know I said I was only going to say two things, but this rule, you can tell, just drives me wacko. The third thing I want to say is the very notion here, this rationale, really proves too much. Why couldn't you say the same thing about somebody who's not a public safety officer, someone who's not a firefighter or a police officer, whose job takes them onto somebody else's property? Why couldn't you say that about mail carriers or delivery persons or restaurant critics or painters or anybody else who comes onto somebody else's property as part of their job? Why don't we apply the same rules with respect to them? Why just public safety employees? This is one of these areas where I would expect to see management and labor linking arms and going to a state legislature and saying, look, this rule makes no sense in this day and age. If someone is negligent, they should bear the risks. We should not bear those risks. Okay. Ramped on. I won't talk about another firefighter's case for at least a year. I promise. Maybe. Well, that's it for the November edition of First Thursday. We hope we're going to see some of you at our, we've got a advanced police discipline seminar that's coming up in Las Vegas in a couple of weeks. And then we take a little bit of a respite until February when we have our seminar, the only one to which we, which is focused purely on unions, we have our union leadership seminar in February. That's going to be an interesting one because we're going to be spending a fair amount of time talking about the fallout from the Supreme Court's Janus decision and the different approaches that unions are taking to deal with that decision. So with that, thank you for bearing with me for a long podcast, and hope to see you next month on First Thursday. This is Will Aitchison signing off.